Today's talk is given by Professor Gary Locke, Professor Emeritus of Archaeology at the University of Oxford, and his talk is entitled Humanising Archaeological GIS. Professor Locke has research interests in computer applications and quantitative methods in archaeology, especially GIS, with current specialist interests in visibility, as well as landscape archaeology, and British later prehistory, especially hill forts, a subject recently looked at from this, our very own MSc here. And Gary is in fact also currently co-directing the Atlas of Hill Forts in Britain and Ireland project with Edinburgh's own Ian Ralston from archaeology. So we therefore look forward to an interesting talk.
Good afternoon, everybody. And first of all, thank you to Owen for inviting me. And thank you all very much for turning up. It's great to see such a large crowd. I'm not sure whether the attraction is me or the refreshments, but anyway, we'll see how it goes. I must say, first of all, that I'm slightly reticent about giving this talk to an audience who I think are mainly geographers, although I do recognise some archaeological faces in the audience, because this talk is very much aimed at an archaeological audience. As I'm sure you all know, there's been a very fruitful interaction between geography and archaeology for a long, long time, stretching back way into the 1970s when David Clark was working with geographers and coming up with all sorts of interdisciplinary approaches, mainly based on landscape. I think it's landscape and concepts of landscape that really bring the two disciplines together. And in fact, my interest in GIS started in the late 1980s, and that was very much through me meeting a geographer. His name is Trevor Harris, he now works in West Virginia, but he introduced me to GIS way back in those early days, and it's developed from there, really. So I'm going to give this talk, which, as I say, is mainly based at an archaeological audience. If I'm saying, at certain points, if I'm saying the blindingly obvious to some of you geographers, then please bear with me, and hopefully there will be some parts of it that you find interesting. I'm just finding out. Right, so humanising archaeological GIS. What I'm going to try and cover very quickly in this talk is, first of all, a brief historical consideration of GIS in archaeology. And the theme that runs through this is very much the integration of GIS with the development of archaeological theory, from processualist positivist days through into post-processualist, post-modernist thinking in archaeology. And this will obviously involve understandings of landscape, understandings of space and spatial thinking, and the importance particularly of models and the importance of scale. And so all of these things are going to come into this talk at various points, and I will expand upon them. So first of all, spatial thinking. Now, I'm sure as geographers, I mean, this is central to what you do every day. It's perhaps not quite so clear for many archaeologists, but spatial thinking, I, as far as I'm concerned, is central to us trying to understand landscapes and central to us trying to apply GIS technology to landscapes and trying to say something meaningful about what landscapes could have meant to past people in the way they perceived and used their landscapes. I think this is quite an interesting and useful definition of spatial thinking. Some of you may be familiar with this. This is taken from a publication by the US National Academies, Learning to Think Spatially. As far as I can see from their website, the main purpose for this was to try and introduce geography into American high schools. But it is quite an interesting breakdown of spatial thinking. Concepts of space, I think, we can loosely equate with theoretical approaches to space. Tools of representation is perhaps the really interesting one in terms of trying to apply GIS, because GIS is very much a tool of representation, and you can see the definition of that there. And then processes of reasoning which I guess we could equate very generally with methodology. So we've got theory, we've got tools of representation, and we've got methodologies. Of course, central to all of this is what we mean by spatial analysis. And the term spatial analysis is a very sort of vague one. It means a lot of different things to different people. But for me, this quote, which as you can see is taken from this, the Smith, Goodchild and Longley, Geospatial Analysis, this quote for me sort of sums up the essence of what this talk is about. And this is, as you can see, that spatial analysis, it runs along parallel tracks. The track of human intuition on the one hand, with all of its vagueness and informality, and the track of the formal, precise world of spatial analysis on the other. And it's the tension between those two things. It's the tension between archaeological theoretical approaches to landscape and understanding landscapes and the precise formal approach that GIS tends to lead you into. It's the tension between those that I'm really going to be talking about this afternoon. So again, just as a bit of background, what's incredibly important to archaeology and I guess geographers as well is the use of models and what we understand by modelling. And here we can see that we take a very sort of general approach to models. There's something that tend to simplify a complex reality and enable us to understand that complex reality in some kind of analytical way. Of course, they're not true. Hang on, I've got a thing here. They're not true, but they're part of a reasoning procedure. Now, the interesting thing about models when we come to look at archaeological theory and changes within that is that they span both the processualist, Clark actually edited a book, Modelling in Archaeology, Models in Archaeology, and he was one of the first people to be explicit about the importance of models and how we use them. He categorised models into all sorts of different types. But even when we get into the postmodernist writings, post-processualism, Shanks and Tilley, who were some of the early post-processualists you may be familiar of, and some of their writings were so dense it was actually difficult to understand what they were trying to get at. But they acknowledged the importance of models as well, and they called them heuristic fictions. And here on the right we can just see one of Binford's, and Binford, as you probably know, was a big processualist. One of his models, this is the very famous toss zone model, people sitting around a campfire and throwing certain bones backwards and certain bones forwards, and you can try and apply that to archaeological excavations, right through to computer-based reconstructions of a Roman temple, such as that one. And of course the importance of modelling is how this fits with the use of GIS. So here we've got a very simple flowchart from the unknowable past, which produces the archaeological record. And what we're trying to say is some kind of interpretive statements about the past in the present. And we work with these different sorts of models. Before computers, we always worked with a data model. We structured data in some way. And we always worked with a theoretical model, whether we were explicit about theory or not. It's in there somewhere. But of course what links these two together within a computer is the digital model. So to what extent can we be true to the three elements of spatial thinking, spatial representation and reasoning within that digital model? So a little bit of history. I keep going back to Clark because I think David Clark was an incredibly important worker in the 1970s within developing theory in archaeology, and Clark differentiated between non-formal spatial theory and formal modelling, particularly the Germanic school with central place theory, site catchment analysis, all of those sorts of landscape-based modelling approaches to landscape, which obviously were borrowed from geography and applied to archaeology. And the way they were applied to archaeology is in these sorts of ways: central place theory. I use hill forts as an example because obviously it's something I'm interested in. But here we can see a series of hill forts divided up by T's and polygons. And of course the argument behind this was that they represent territories and settlement hierarchies. If you look at farmsteads around hill forts, you've got a hill fort within a territory and economic and social relationships. We've got site catchment analysis there. And we've got systems theory, which was very big in archaeology in the 1970s. So all of these are very much to do with economic modelling. So here you can see the hill fort, you can see all sorts of links between different elements of the system. So when GIS first arrived in archaeology, and here we're talking about, my first involvement was in 1988, the first influential book was published in 1990, this is Alan Zubrow and Green's Interpreting Space, and that was really when GIS hit the archaeological world, I would argue. And you can see that what people tended to do, and this is fairly typical of sort of early adopters of a new technology, they tried to repeat the things that they were already doing, but using the new technology. So here we've got a typical GIS application of a sort of site catchment analysis. These are beaker, early Bronze Age beaker sites in Spain, and you can see that what they're looking at are resources such as salt and flint sources around the settlements. Now the problem with this in 1990 is that we were already 10 years into the rejection of these approaches by the vast majority of archaeologists and the adoption and development of postmodernist, post-processual thinking about landscapes. And the big criticism, and GIS was heavily criticised, as you may know, when it first arrived in archaeology. And I must say that to some extent, GIS is still criticised in archaeology. If you read some of the works of theoreticians like Chris Tilley and Julian Thomas, they're still quite critical of GIS, claiming that it's a technology that is not taking us anywhere in terms of understanding archaeological landscapes. And of course the big criticism was to do with the God trick, looking at landscapes from above, so you're actually seeing everything but you're positioned nowhere. That was the big sort of criticism. And Dave Wheatley from Southampton wrote a paper in 1993 basically laying out what he thought were the ways that we should go forward with archaeological GIS. And what he suggested is that rather than the God trick, we needed to actually place people in the landscape. As analysts, we needed to position ourselves within those landscapes. And the way that archaeological GIS users picked up on this was through visibility and movement. So with visibility, we've got a whole series of techniques from line of sight to binary view sheds, cumulative view sheds, which is just adding lots of view sheds together, and what are called visibility indices, which is where for a whole landscape you've got a sort of total view shed breakdown of the whole landscape. So for any point on that landscape, you can tell what its visible characteristics are. And here you can see some of Dave Wheatley's attempts to apply cumulative view sheds to these different landscapes. Similarly with movement, from least cost paths to least cost surfaces and accessibility indices, and tied in with those times of movement. How far can you get within 1 hour or 2 hours from an archaeological site? Those sorts of approaches. And here we've got a least cost surface for a hill fort called Danebury, and you can see, well perhaps you can't see, but there are field systems and various other things around it, and what we're doing is trying to model access to these different these different sites.
So that was the early to mid 1990s.
A long time ago in terms of technological developments. So what's happened so far? What's changed so far? Some people would argue not very much at all. And one of these people is Jeremy Huggett from Glasgow, who some of you may know, archaeologist at Glasgow. And what Jeremy Huggett has argued is that GIS, to a large extent, is seen as a technology of enchantment, a technology of beguilement. And what this produces is a technopoly, a state of culture, state of mind, that blah, 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 you can read it there. But the important thing is that this produces soft technological determinism. And I think this is quite an interesting point in terms of using GIS. Why do so many people these days use a viewshed? Why do so many people do a line of sight or a least cost path? Because it's there on the menu, you can press a button and you can do it. This is, some people would argue, technological determinism. What we need to do is to get beneath that to understand the sort of theory that underlies those approaches, as well as, of course, the implications of the particular algorithms that are being used, which is not always that easy to do if you're using something like ArcGIS or something like that. Right. The other thing that I would think is crucial to this, and I'm still on the background here, is the so-called crisis of representation. And this is something, I'll talk about this a little bit later, but this is something that's become big in geography, I think, according to my reading, and also is just being picked up in archaeology. Archaeology often lags a little bit behind geography in terms of these developments. But the crisis of representation. And I think there are two complicating factors there. Landscape and scale. What do we mean by landscape? And in archaeology, certainly, there are two different approaches to landscape. There's the measuring and recording, collecting data approach, and there is also, and this is an and or, perceiving, understanding, living, humanising landscapes. I know some people who call themselves landscape archaeologists who do this and really wouldn't want to get involved in any of that. So landscape as data, and I mean this is what lots of archaeologists do, we collect all these different data sources, we put them together in a GIS, we see what overlaps where, we do some basic analysis, we produce maps, and that is called landscape archaeology. There's this whole other school of landscape archaeology, which is based on narrative. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but you get the gist, I think, by just scanning that. And this is postmodernism, it's to do with uncertainty, multivocality, Tillis phenomenology, can you walk around a landscape and understand it in some way that will tell you something about how people in the Iron Age understood it. The whole space and place argument, and here we introduce Tim Ingold, the anthropologist, who's written a lot about this. Sacred and ritual landscapes, and of course, lately, we've got this whole idea of social practice and agency, which is also coming into landscape studies. So it's a very different approach to just collecting data. I'm not saying that the two won't go together, but quite often they don't. This latter approach is also represented in more formal legislative type of approaches to landscape. So here we've got the European Landscape Convention, and notice this quote taken from this, that the focus of landscape is on the perception. An area as perceived by people whose character is the result of the action and interaction of natural. So it's perception there. And we've also got World Heritage Sites for the Intangible Heritage. A really interesting idea, I think. And this is Jamr el-Fanar, the main square in the middle of Marrakesh in Morocco, which is a World Heritage site for the intangible heritage. It's nothing to do with the buildings that are there, it's to do with what people do in terms of actions and cultural embedding within that place. Scale is the other crucial thing which underlies a lot of this. Scale is a bit of a slippery concept. I mean, as archaeologists and I think probably as geographers, we use scale all the while. We're always slipping between different scales, whether we acknowledge it or whether we don't acknowledge it, and quite often we don't. So we've got scale as a concept, an analytical framework, and as a lived experience. So here's an Iron Age hill fort that I excavated a few years ago in Oxfordshire. And this is the ditch with a massive rampart on the outside of it. So we can just draw it to scale as we've done there. But what's more interesting, I think, and what's more critical in terms of understanding this landscape is the phenomenological approach to scale. This is Ingold's dwelling perspective. How would the scale of this thing actually have impacted on people as they walked up towards this rampart and they saw the size of the ditch and the size of the rampart? That sort of impact on people and on emotions, if you like. Scales of reasoning then, from the 60s and 70s, general cultural processes, to these days, or for some people these days, isolated impersonal subjectivity. And what we've got to try and do is find a middle ground, a way forward, which is much more multi-dimensional. GIS has its own formal definitions of what it, of how you describe a place, and I think I don't need to go into this in much detail, as most of you in the room, I think, are GIS users. Location, attributes, all these sorts of things define a place loosely described in GIS terms. But can we get beyond these formal models? So what I'm going to do here is just outline some of the work that myself and a couple of my PhD students have done over the last few years. This was a very early piece of work. This was probably mid to late 1990s, and this was one of my projects called the Hill Forts of the Ridgeway Project. The Ridgeway is a long distance, presumably prehistoric trackway in Oxfordshire. It goes along the edge of the Wessex Downlands. So to the north is the Vale of the White Horse. This is Chalk Downlands. And there's a whole series of hill forts, as you can see. Iron Age hill forts dating from about 7th century BC along this trackway. Notice that the grain of the land is very much north to south, lots of dry valleys. And so the argument is that if people wanted to move east to west across this landscape, the edge of the Chalk Downland is the obvious place to move along. So the first thing that we did was, really looking back on it, quite naive. We used binary view sheds from the hill forts to try and get an idea of long distance visibility. So this is one, I can't remember which one this one is, it's probably Uffington Castle, which is there, where the Uffington prehistoric white horse is. And you can see it's got a massive view shed. But, of course, it's a binary view shed. So, you know, all the problems associated with visibility in terms of distance come into this. The next thing we wanted to do was to see if the hill forts were located to be visible as you moved along the ridgeway. So we did a series of limited view sheds, 3 kilometre range, at 250 metre intervals along the ridgeway. We then added them all together, and so a cumulative view shed. And at the high visibility points, you would expect those to correlate with the hill forts if they were positioned to be visible as you moved along the ridgeway. And in fact, they weren't. There was no correlation whatsoever. So the suggestion is that they weren't positioned to be visible. Now, when we picked this work up again a couple of years ago, for whatever reasons. We sort of could see with hindsight how naive that was. And what we started to think about a bit more is how people actually do move. How do people walk and move across a landscape? And it became very clear to us that they don't move along single paths if there isn't a path there. So we're interested in developing this idea of a corridor of intentionality. We want to get from here to a point over there, and there's a corridor, and we always move with intention to get somewhere. We don't just wander aimlessly around the landscape. There's also the idea of waypoints. If you want to get from here to there, you may well aim at something that's midway, which you know is a midway point, or at least a point on the way to where you want to get to. The other thing is that when you're walking, you don't look around 360 degrees, so a complete view shed. I mean, you don't walk with your head spinning around. You walk generally looking in the direction that you're going. So a cone of visibility, a cone of vision, is much more appropriate. The two people that inspired us in terms of theory are Tim Ingold, and if you're not familiar with Tim Ingold's work, I do recommend it, and he describes movement as that, and Gibson, J.J. Gibson, who's an environmental psychologist whose writings now are quite old, but he came up with the idea of affordance, and we're thinking that a landscape creates affordance. A landscape offers you the opportunity to move in certain directions. And you can see some of the things that he said there. But of course, the important thing about both of these is that they integrate visibility and movement. You don't usually move without looking, and you quite often look with the intention of moving. So theoretically, there's a very strong argument for integrating visibility and movement. This is a quote from Martin van Loosen, who some of you may be familiar with. He's worked a lot in archaeological GIS, that GIS incorporate no global knowledge. But one of our arguments is that this doesn't apply to the way people walk. I think, perhaps not these days, but certainly a few years ago, the accepted argument for doing visibility and movement studies was that you needed to get the finest resolution DEM that you could get. 100 metre DEM resolution was not much use. If you could get 5 metres or 1 metres, it gives you a much more meaningful result in terms of movement and visibility. Well, that doesn't really fit with the way people move, because when you're walking along, you don't look at the 1 metre in front of you. You obviously look way ahead to wherever you're going or the waypoint that you're going to. So we decided to mess around with this a little bit, and we developed scales of analysis that are independent of the DEM cell size. We played with different windows of analysis. And this was to a different emphasis on efficiency, and different scales could illustrate different relationships with topography. So, for example, here we've got a series of least cost pathways which model the ridgeway that I've mentioned earlier. And here you can see we've got different windows. So these windows are meant to model the distance that the person is looking ahead as they move along this landscape. And that distance ahead influences the way they move. So it influences the generation of the least cost path. And you can see they go up in size. So this is 10 metre DEM. So this is about a kilometre. This is looking, the yellow one that you can see there, is looking about a kilometre ahead, and what you can see a kilometre ahead is influencing the movement. Now, the important thing here is that there's a whole range of different paths across that landscape. Now, I'm not arguing that any of those are the right, correct path. All I'm saying is that we can use modelling in this way to give us a variation of feel for the variation of how we can move across this landscape. So if we get a very close match to the topography, it can tell us one thing. If we get a very poor match to the topography, it will tell us something different. And as I've already mentioned, we can feed into this directional view sheds and corridors of intentionality. So what we did next was that from the hill forts, to try and influence these paths of movement, we created a cone of visibility as you go towards the hill fort. And the cone of visibility was then fed into the algorithm for movement, the least cost path algorithm. So in this one example, this is a hill fort called Liddington Castle, then what we're doing here is modelling movement from this other hill fort called Barbary Castle. So the red is the modern ridgeway. The black is the 1 kilometre window pathway that we saw earlier. And the blue one is the one that takes the waypoint. And here the waypoint is Liddington Castle because, as you can see, it's visible. So as you get closer to it, so the visibility becomes stronger, so to speak, and gives more influence over the algorithm, in the algorithm towards movement. We then moved on to think a bit more about visibility as cost. So this is when generating a least cost path. And we came up with two ideas. One is what we call restrictive cumulative view shed, RCV, where again we have a window of analysis, we have accumulated visibility for each cell, which goes from 0 to 1, and we argue that this gives us a certain fuzziness in terms of visibility and landscape. The other approach is a paper that some of you may be familiar with. This is a fairly old paper, Lee and Stuckey, 1998, and they came up with the idea of view paths, and we worked this up slightly differently. So Lee and Stuckey's paper is in IJGIS, 1998, and here they came up with the idea of what they call view grids. So view grid general, view grid dominance, is equivalent to looking out and looking in to any particular cell. So looking out is what you can see from that cell, and looking in is the number of places, the number of other cells that cell is visible from. So there's a difference there, obviously, because line of sight is not reciprocal, as you probably know. If you're using offsets, you can't automatically see both ways. They also fed in slope and distance, and they compared it with the Euclidean path, which is the straightest, easiest route. They came up with various friction surfaces based on what they suggested were four different paths. The hidden path, which is low visibility, scenic path, which is high visibility, strategic path, and withdrawn path. We just played around with hidden path and scenic path because we thought they would demonstrate the biggest difference. And we were just sort of exploring this to see if it might be useful. So in this case, our case study area is an area called around a hill fort in Hampshire called Damery. And we've looked at a group of long barrows. So these are Neolithic long barrows. And we've chosen these four in red there because of their different topographical positions within the landscape. So we generated VG, which is view grid general, VD, which is view grid dominance. So that's visibility out from a cell, that's visibility into a cell, and so for each cell you get these images and these DEM equivalents. Now, for RCV, because this is a restricted cumulative view shed, you need to decide on the distance that you're restricting it to. This is equivalent to how far you see that influences how you move. And what we decided to do here, rather than just choosing figures at random or plucking them out of the air, is that we did an horizon analysis. So we looked at what we call the local horizon, which is the green, and the global horizon, which is the red. And this is through a whole number of lines of sights and taking the average as you move along the Euclidean path between these barrows. So the green are the sort of immediate horizon, the red is the distance horizon, and our argument underlying this is that by using one of those or the other of those, it would influence the way that you move across the landscape. And here you can see some differences in these images. This is the DEM produced from the local horizon, global, total, and this is a simple binary view shed. Sorry, these are view sheds produced from these, and this is a simple binary view shed from Barrow 15. So you can see there are quite considerable differences in terms of using these for analysis. So this is using the total view shed. The scenic path is green, the hidden path is blue, the path based just on slope is red, and the Euclidean path, the most direct, is black. So the hidden and scenic paths are based on visibility, and Lee and Stuckey's different definitions of hidden and scenic paths. Now, I'm not going to go into these in great detail, but the important thing is to see that there are differences. And the obvious point to make is that there are many different sorts of paths you can generate between two points. Doing a single least cost path, I would argue, is a pretty meaningless thing to do. What you need to do is explore with all of these different approaches. And if you look at this in detail, you can see that the scenic path tends to stick to the high ground. This is fairly obvious. The hidden path tends to take to the valley bottoms and the low points, obviously to be more visible or to be less visible. So this is just the hidden paths, and this is using the local view shed and the global view shed to influence the path. So this is looking a short distance ahead, and it's looking a long distance ahead. So you can see, I mean, I'm sort of assuming that you're not picking up all the detail of this, because it is quite detailed, but the point I'm trying to get over is that by modelling these things, you can get a whole wealth of different sorts of information from doing this. Similarly with the scenic paths there. But what we decided was that really these single paths are interesting, but in terms of corridors of intentionality, then no single path would really give us any sort of meaningful answer. So what we decided to do was to combine these within a probability surface, and you can see the probabilities there for these different paths, and you can do this by using the, I think it's the corridor, corridor function within ArcGIS, and this is just a reminder of what we're actually talking about here. And what I would argue is that representation is the important point. What we've been looking at so far, there's theory underlying it, obviously, but we're sort of limited by the representation within the GIS software. We could take this even further in terms of a critique, and these, certainly Thrift and Lorimer, are geographers, and what they've argued is that representation in any form is extremely limiting. So Thrift, for example, quite a long time ago, came up with what he called non-representational theory, and he uses, you know, these sorts of concepts like engaged agency and habitation as practice. And then later than that, Lorimer came up with what he calls more than representational theory. And in this, he argues that what we need attention to aspects of life that are beyond the academic gaze, which is a bit of a sort of critique of what we all do, I think. And what the academic gaze does is it uncovers meaning, measuring and analysis, interpreting, and what's crucial is we need to be able to represent that. But he argues that there's a whole range of aspects of life and understanding landscapes that are beyond the academic gaze. So I think that is the real challenge in terms of what we're talking about here. I just mentioned one other, and this is the idea of deep maps. I don't know if any of you have come across this book by Mike Pearson. It's called In Comes I. And it's a whole new approach to trying to understand and represent landscapes and perception of place at different scales, local and regional. And it's a very, very interesting approach. But, I would argue, offers a huge challenge to those of us interested in using GIS and trying to represent landscapes and understanding of landscapes through GIS. So we've got this continuing tension. And the tension is between model and modelling, spatial analysis, the scientific method, as it's sometimes called, quantitative cartographic space, and the sort of approach that GIS leads us into. And the tension is with the narrative approach to landscape and to archaeology, where we're much more interested in nuanced emphasis of individuals, the role of storytelling, all that sort of thing that you can see there. Is there a way forward? I'm not going to suggest any way forward. People have suggested different ways forward. One of them is a man I've already mentioned, Trevor Harris. And I don't know if you're familiar with this book. It's called The Spatial Humanities, GIS and the Future of Humanities Scholarship. Came out a couple of years ago. But in there, Trevor Harris has a paper about Web 2 technologies. It's about what he calls informal GIS rather than formal GIS. And it involves all these sorts of concepts that I'm sure many of you, particularly the geographers, are familiar with. Authoritative versus assertive information, volunteer geographic information, all that. And it's the we think philosophy rather than the I think philosophy. I mean, I'm extremely dubious about all of this, whether it really does represent a way forward in terms of understanding landscapes. For me, a more interesting approach, or a couple of interesting approaches that I'm going to finish with, are from a couple of young scholars who have recently finished PhDs in archaeology, trying to think about theoretical, the integration of theory and archaeological GIS. One is Perey Hatzigüzela, sorry I can't pronounce her surname, she's Turkish. Performance and redefining our relationship with GIS technology, that's what she was sort of trying to do. And she came up with this idea of spatial narratives. She used the chain opératoire idea, but reformed it into a spatial approach. And she looked at cooking practices in Bronze Age Marlia on Crete. So this is one of the buildings she looked at. She started off with a fairly simple approach of a cost surface and binary view sheds, a series of binary view sheds. But what she did was integrate the artifactual evidence with the GIS approach and the spatial approach. And this is something that hasn't been done very often. It's not a sort of common thing to do. So within these buildings, she plotted all of the artifacts and the structures that are to do with cooking. and the production of food. So this is hearths, grinding stones, cups and plates, all those sorts of things. And what she tried to do was to create spatial narratives for different numbers of people in terms of preparing a meal and serving a meal. And she came up with all these sorts of plots, some of them producing some very interesting sorts of ways that a building might be used. And of course this integrates the whole philosophy of practice, that we understand places, we understand life generally through what people do. The second one is a man named Vuk Trifkevich, and the whole emphasis of what he did was on persons and landscapes. He looked at a whole series of Mesolithic, Neolithic sites on the Danube. This is the Iron Gates Gorge in Serbia. He uses banded visibility. So this is by now a fairly well-known technique in archaeology. Higuchi view sheds, where you divide a view shed up into different bands depending on the quality of the visibility at different ranges. He actually looked at individual biographies, so some of these sites have been excavated. He looked at evidence within houses and also burials, and the pathology of some of the people in burials. He then tried to relate this to natural resources. Here we've got lithic resources, wild boar, and he also looked at various other animals. And he came up with cost paths to access these resources. He also came up with what he called pathology paths, because some of the burials showed that people had certain disabilities, and he was trying to model how people with disabilities would perhaps move across these landscapes. And then he looked at the way that graves, viewshed from graves, were located, and came up with some really interesting sort of conclusions, that some of the graves were obviously orientated onto landscape features. And one of the interesting things about the burials at these sites, if you're not familiar with them, is that some of the burials are actually in a sitting position. People were buried sitting upright, obviously with the intention of viewing a particular direction. And so, for example, there was a burial with grave goods that were to do with fishing, and that person was positioned to look out over the river. So, conclusion. The conclusions are a bit vague and obvious, really, because I'm not proposing that I've got answers to this tension that I've identified. But I would say that formal GIS has got limited capabilities. If we want to take space representation and reasoning forward within a sort of modern, believable, archaeological, theoretical framework. GIS-based archaeology must be based upon a critical engagement. Spatial theory has to be central to any GIS application. Now that may sound a very obvious thing to say, but believe me, I see so many GIS applications in archaeology which really are at the level of push button, technological determinism. Let's do a view shed. We can press this button and do a view shed, with very little theoretical justification underpinning it. Archaeological questions always have, and I would argue will, push the boundaries of GIS technology. I mean, GIS technology is not really designed for the sorts of some of the things that we want to do as archaeologists. I'm not saying all things. I mean, there's a whole lot of heritage management applications, drawing maps, all those sorts of things. GIS is a wonderful technology. But when you get to the interface between landscape theory and applications, it struggles a bit. Scale is central. And what
to a large extent we're talking about is a qualitative understanding of what has to be quantified data in one way to be able to get it into a GIS. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions from the audience, perhaps?
All right, I'll start. So I'm an ecologist, so this was Hockney. I was really interested in your analysis of all your secret views and hidden views, and I just wondered whether you were maybe falling into your own the trap of your own conclusion there, where you were doing all this wonderful technological analysis, but what you didn't have in your analysis about the routes from A to B was the practicalities of footing it and hoofing it. What was the easiest route to walk? You didn't actually have that in. Did you dismiss that as a
I mean, this is all modelling. I accept this is all computer based modelling. I mean, we haven't been there and walked those routes. But what we're trying to do, I mean, we're not trying to come up with a definitive answer, obviously, that this is the way they walk between these barrows. We're just trying to almost demonstrate a methodology that there are lots of different ways of doing this, if you're thinking about moving between two points.
My question is very similar to Cameron's, actually. When I was looking at that, I was thinking, I suppose when we're putting it, how do you get the gold standard? How do you work out whether your model is right? You know, in other fields, you might design a model, and then you get some human judges to do a test case where you know what the answer is, and you compare against that. Now, that's very difficult in this situation, and I was wondering if you've got any method for, either actually sending real people out there. Because there must be so many hidden variables, like what the undergrowth was like, and that kind of thing. It's very difficult to model.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there's any scope for analysing, trying to find a gold standard in the model situation, and applying your model and seeing if you can match it.
Well, first of all, let me say that there's all sorts of things that we accept as archaeologists generally, and one is that it's very difficult to reconstruct past vegetation, land use, and all those sorts of things. So this is a simplified model of topography and landscape. But having said that, again, the assumption that we usually accept is that the sort of bones of the landscape, the actual hills and valleys, would have been pretty much the same then. I mean, okay, there's been colluviation, there's been erosion, whatever. But the bones of the landscape would have been the same back then as they are now. I mean, they're general assumptions. The other thing I'd say is that we're really not trying to show that our model is right. I'm not quite sure what you mean by showing that the model is right. I mean, it's a model, it's a methodology that people can use. Yes. I mean, I guess the simple answer is we won't, and we won't even try to validate that hypothesis. This is just a model that we're trying to show different approaches through. I'm not quite sure how we could validate a model like that, to be honest.
Well,
I mean, we could
get a bunch of people and send them out.
Yes, we could.
You could find more situations.
But you see, the thing is,
it
does seem to me that unless you're trying to prove your model, all you're doing is doing exactly the same as conclusion, and you're using GIS because you can.
No, we're not. No, because the difference is, you can't press a button and do what we've done. You could press a button and produce a view shed. I mean, our argument is that we've developed some theory that underlies it, and the theory is that visibility in different ways, whether it's local horizon, distance horizon, whether it's waypoints or whatever, I mean, there are lots of different ways of thinking about how visibility works. We've developed methods where those ideas of visibility can feed into modelling the way that people move.
So prove your model then.
You could test it though, because what you can do is you can use that as a base to create a predictive model about where something else would be. Let's say you're not using hill forts, you're using visibility or something else like cairns. You create a model where you predict other sites might be, and then you go out and test how reliable that method is, and then you could actually say, this was actually something that factored into those people's perceptions in the past, and it's meaningful for them. Because that's the one trick. You know, you create lots of models on these things, but do the models actually mean anything to anyone? Because, I mean, one of the things you didn't use is something like least cost as far as Tobler's function, you know, anisotropic, where you take into the impact that the frame has on movement. If you do take those types of things into account, the assumption is that the people were thinking about those things in the past, or at least maybe not intuitively doing it, but doing it non-intuitively, and it's very difficult to actually measure that's the case.
Mm. Well, measure if it's the case that they were thinking about that in the past.
Those things. I mean, when I go for a hike, you know, you often, sometimes they're very organised, and I get a contour map out, and I have a look about it, and I think about following contours, and which is the least cost way to do it. But most of the time, I just go out, and you get pulled into work.
Yeah.
And there might be an underlying assumption that people inherently think about those things without actually thinking about them, and it's going on in the subconscious when they're looking at the landscape.
But I think as archaeologists, if we had to in some way validate or prove what people were thinking in the past, we'd never do anything because we can't do that.
You can't do it, you're right there, but you can at least attempt to, and that's part of the process, isn't it? Because I'm trying to get that, trying to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that what we're seeing here is a sort of disciplinary difference. I hesitate to say this, but I'm sort of feeling that you come from a much more quantitative background. Certainly when you're talking about hypothesis testing and all those sorts of approaches, we tend not to do that in archaeology. I'm sure some archaeologist is going to stand up and shout at me at some point. But I suspect we've probably got slight disciplinary differences showing themselves here.
Quantitative archaeologists, so here we go.
I'm not going to deal with that. I know I've been strategically avoiding giving an answer to a question before, but it does seem that maybe you're tackling pathological aspects. Still, the phenomenological side is primarily visibility based on what we've done. I think Chapman has spoken a little bit about bringing other aspects of phenomenology into GIS applications.
Yeah.
Have you looked into that? What are your feelings on that? Do you think that is actually achievable tool, or are there aspects of that way of looking at landscapes that you need to improve your landscape?
Do you mean things like sound and smell? Those are the sorts of senses
that are kind of spoken by a fairly
I mean, there have been little bits of work done with what people have called sound sheds and smell sheds, I think. I have nothing against those approaches, and I think they perhaps could be integrated in some way. It's sort of difficult to suggest where the sound or the smell would emanate from, if you see where I mean, what I mean. I mean, the piece of work I'm thinking of is a whole series of medieval churches, and somebody tried to model the sound of the bells ringing. Which was interesting.
This is because, I mean, the aim is to include other aspects and not tie ourselves down to technological limitations affecting the search. Is that something we're striving for, or even just using visibility that we already sort of subservient to technological limits?
No, I've nothing against integrating other senses at all. I do sort of feel that the visibility is probably the most important sense. Certainly, if you're talking about movement over any distance, I think there's a lot more to be got from analysing visibility in more sensitive ways. I mean, a lot of visibility studies are very crude.
Isn't that the core, though, of what the problem with humanising giants is, in the sense that there's certain things that just don't fit into the space model? We go back to Hegel's critiques from the mid-90s.
Yes, but is that an argument for not trying?
Yes, exactly.
Any more questions in the wider room?
I wondered about the input of a lot of recent architectural theory around planning and using a lot of the same sorts of authors like in Robert. I think Richard Quay here at Edinburgh is very involved in some of the sort of like postmodern ideas about planning for architectural purposes. And potential application of those sorts of models and what's developing in that discipline to
I'm not aware of those sorts of ideas being applied at a landscape level in archaeology. Certainly there's been some interest in those at a sort of architectural level, you know, intra-building analysis. Sort of similar to space syntax sort of approaches. It sort of doesn't apply to archaeology. Processionalism, post-procession obviously equate to sort of modernism and post-modernism. And processionalism was roughly the 60s and 70s, and then post-processionalism. But processionalism is so called because archaeology in those days was more interested in processes. So, for example, systems theory, modelling processes on the larger scale, larger sort of cultural scales. So tied in with that was the sort of idea that there were cross-cultural laws that you could identify and apply in all sorts of different circumstances.
The other question was that interest from that period, which I kind of vaguely
Oh, yes. I didn't want to give the impression that everybody in archaeology, you know, in 1980 changed from being a processionalist to a post-processionist. Obviously not. And the remnants of some of those techniques and ideas are still used by some archaeologists these days. I mean, it's a much more a sort of mix and match type of approach these days. Yes, I'm not suggesting that we threw the baby out with the bathwater.
No, I mean, it was just later on, purely interesting that the interest in the suppose had from placing its fragments and stuff, did it contribute helpful to archaeology?
I'm not familiar with all periods of archaeology where it would have been used. I mean, my own interest is the Iron Age. And it was sort of interesting in the Iron Age, interesting. But I don't think anyone studying the Iron Age these days would take into account any of those earlier analyses. There may be an archaeologist in the room who disagrees with me. Please speak up if you do.
Okay, I'll profile. Well, I think perhaps we might let you off the hook there and give us time to retire for EGIG drinks afterwards. I'm trying to think of something witty to say, but basically, in terms of immersing ourselves in landscape. If anyone's been following the Craighouse developments, the old Napier's old Craighouse campus, I think today or something, some photo montages, the visibility analysis came into play, and there's a bit of a before and after spot the difference competition there, but the photos look remarkably the same, and they're very immersed. In fact, they're so immersed, they're right up against the sort of road junction, the block of flats. Because the thing about Craighouse is that it sits on a rock, if you like, admired from across Edinburgh. And of course, they're trying to get their planning consent by showing a sort of tree in a block of flats as it is right now. So it's perhaps a bit too immersed, but it's quite amusing. Anyway, so I'll leave it at that. But just obviously, thanks to all of you for coming. Thanks to the volunteers for a great setup job, letting me off the hook. And thanks indeed to Gary for an interesting talk.